This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, we are well into the Hanukkah season, and Christmas is just a very short time away, and time for you to start actually wrapping up those gifts that you've purchased. And if you haven't, now's a good time perhaps to make those last dreams come true for a lot of your loved ones. And if you still have any money left in the bank, you might think about becoming a friend of the Magic Word. I always have to push that and remind you, just go to themagicwordpodcast.com. There you can see a tab where it says, become a friend of the Magic Word, and it will give you some information about why it is that we could use your support for helping keep this podcast going. Thank you guys very much for coming back every week and to listening to this podcast. We've got another amazing podcast episode here this week, because this goes back to a friend of mine who I have known since, oh golly, the early 1980s, I guess. We'll get into that in just a few moments. But before we do, I want to remind you, of course, we have not one, but two different contests. Well, really three contests that are going on currently, and that all you have to do is go to themagicwordpodcast.com. Two of the contests are for the same thing. In other words, that it is for an ebook of The Magic Square, which is a part of the Eli Marks mystery series that's written by John Gaspard. Excellent series. I highly recommend it. You should read it or listen to the Audible books. And he has graciously agreed to give away three copies. And in order to give a little bit of help to those who are our international listeners, we have a special entry form there on the site that says for international listeners only. Go ahead, and if you're outside the U.S., go ahead and put your name and email address in that form, and you might have a better chance to get someone a copy of this ebook. And then there is another contest that's running for everybody else, that is those in the U.S. as well as those who are international. The other contest is to get an opportunity to win a copy of the Subtle Card Creations, I believe it is called, Volume 8, the Nick Trost series that has been published by Charlie Randall of H&R Magic Books, and he has graciously agreed to give away six books. Now, all of these things are going to run for another week. Next week is going to be December the 24th, which will be our Thursday episode, and that's going to be on Christmas Eve, and so the names will be announced, and so you will not be receiving this on Christmas. Well, you will the ebooks. I guess those could conceivably arrive for Christmas Day, since it would be coming into your inbox, and you could just download that. But as for the physical copies of the books, those will be shipped out, and probably get those sometime before or after the first of this next year. So be sure to go and check that out at the magicwordpodcast.com and enter the contest. So, as I said, this week's episode is with someone that I've been wanting to get together with for quite some time, and I finally tracked him down. He is a magic collector and someone who has been collecting magic posters for a long time, is well-versed, well-known in the magic poster community, basically, a collector's community. And he also is working on a book on Ionia. He's been working on that for quite some time, and we talk about that then as well. But along with that he is well known as being one of the top restaurant workers. Gosh, when he was working here in Houston back in the 80s, I believe he was working maybe 9 or 11 different restaurants, I think, in one week, each week. So he was just all over town, plus making a lot of contacts, which launched him into a different career as being a trade show magician, very successful trade show magician. And also what he's doing now is baking. So as we are talking this week, he actually, you can kind of hear in the background some of the clattering around in his kitchen as he's talking to me on the phone and recording this conversation as he is baking some baguettes. And apparently he is one of the top baguette bakers in the country. He's going to talk a little bit about that then too. So this just really covers a wide field of interest, whether that you're a collector, a baker, or a magic creator, because Charles Green is all of those and more. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Charles Green III, here on The Magic Word.
Hello, Scott.
Hello, Charles Green. Hello, how are you?
I don't know. I've got too much technology going on. I've got you. It's on Skype. It's with a new headset. I'm looking at I'm going deep into my computer files because I'm working on getting someone some magic poster images from many, many years ago, and they want large files for a publication. So,
is this something that you say there were posters from a long time ago that they've contacted you, and they're large files, and you're just trying to dig them out of your computer file someplace?
No, well, so the story is there's someone who has approached me because they're doing an article on, and I'm looking at this online as I'm like reading this out. They're doing an article that relates to Egyptology. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking for magic posters that deal with Egypt. And there are quite a few that have, you know, Egyptian motifs, the Sphinx, you know, Carter on the camel, Houdini buried alive, George posters, Thurston. So they approached me through magicpostergallery.com and said, hey, you've got these images. Can I use these? But do you have larger files that I could use for publication?
For high resolution, I guess.
Exactly. So they want like 300 DPI by like 8x10. Mm-hmm. And I have some, but, you know, I don't have all that they're looking for. And of course, you know, since this was done, that project, magicpostergallery.com, was done so many years ago. Those are just deep files. So there we go.
So is that something that you're going to go back and do and take some pictures of higher res with of posters that you have and update your website?
Well, the posters on the website don't really need updating as far as high res. What this is for is when someone approaches me and says, hey, I've got a project and I want to put this in a magazine. Mm-hmm. Because for the website, I just need 72 DPI and that's perfectly fine. And I've got lots of those.
Well, you could still have those as thumbnails, and that would be good enough for the website. But if someone wants to go deeper to use that as a higher res, they can click on that, and it would take them to another page.
Well, they could do that, but then I don't want everyone – so one issue I've had that I've learned, you know, just with technology over the years, mm-hmm. is that some people have gone onto the site and just taken images and either just used them on their site without any acknowledgement whatsoever, or have actually printed items from higher res images. Right. So to prevent that, that's why the 72 image things are up there. And also because there are so many posters, that just takes up a lot of room when you're doing 300 DPI and you've got, I'm not sure how many, you know, 1,000 different images up there.
Well, that makes sense. Well, going then to actually who owns the images, I mean, the posters were made by Otis and others, the photographers and others in the past. And although that you would own a copy of one, and so if you post an image, who actually would own the image? I guess because you'd posted it, you own it, and if I upload one, I would own it, or how does that work?
Well, as I always do it, if I have an image, so in general, because these posters are over 100 years old, they are all open to creative use. Mm-hmm. So basically anyone can take them and use them. But if I went to someone's website and they had a poster image up there, I would approach them and say, hey, you've got this image up there. It's not like it's – especially if it's not one of a kind. But even if it is, you know, I just wouldn't go through someone's website and just gather all the images, throw them on my poster site and then say, hey, I'm done. So that's the scoop.
So it's better actually to have your – to own the poster, to have purchased it or something. What if you went to a gallery? Let's say that you go to Potter & Potter when they're having a – I mean, I know for an example that they publish those great books and saying here's what's going to be coming up for auction, and they have beautiful photos taken of that. And those images, I assume, then are owned by Gabe Fiore and the Potter & Potter Auction House. But if you go in to physically see those posters and you take a picture yourself, then – although you may not purchase the poster, but you have taken a photo of that, and then you can post that, I guess, on your website. Would that be – what are your thoughts on that? I mean, I don't know about that.
I would consider that ethical. I think that's fair. I mean, I think that that's what a lot of people do, and I think the image is like if you go in and you take a picture of a whatever, let's say a Houdini poster, then you own – I mean, it's your image. If I were to do that, I would probably have to give some kind of recognition to where I got the poster image from. Mm-hmm. But essentially, you know, your image is – if you take a picture of the image, then it's yours. I think that there's just a general courtesy. So let's say I go into someone's home and they've got a poster that's up, or they've got just some item that is, you know, we assume it's been said that it's unique.
Okay.
Then if I take a picture of it, I wouldn't just say, hey, I can put this anywhere because it's a unique image. And just from a courtesy standpoint, it's really not mine to, you know, put out there because, you know.
Because it's owned by somebody else.
It's owned by someone else and they'd like to have some exclusivity to it.
Which is why I assume that museums don't like you to take photos in the museum.
No, I don't think that most people mind. I think there's a general thing of a lot of museums will not let you use flash.
Oh, just because it might go to destroy the images?
Right, just the flash will destroy an image. And because most people are not discreet or using their discretionary powers, especially with phones these days, because everyone's got a phone. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know how to turn off their flash and just, you know, if you get, I know, 100 people who don't know how to turn off their flash and they are photographing an image that's photosensitive, then you've got a problem.
I recall.
So in general, you know, just say don't take photos. But I was just at we were just at some of the museums this past weekend, and in looking at some of the placards, there's a sign that says there's like a photo and an X on something, but it's for no flash photography, not just no photography.
Oh, so you can't take it. Gotcha.
You can take photos, yeah. And then some, you know, I guess just depending on the museum, they may just say, hey, no photography allowed.
I recall on a kind of related subject, Kathy and I had gone to Australia, and then we were down like in Tasmania and saw these fairy penguins, and there was a gallery we can sit in benches and watch these penguins come in. It was after dark, and they said, don't take any flash photography because it will disrupt their general nature, I guess, in finding their way back to their holes or wherever they're in their families, you know, after they come out of those, because they're coming back to feed their families, basically, after they've been in there for, I don't know, days or weeks or whatever. The point is that it's, even though they're saying that and there are signs every place, it just looked like paparazzi, just people taking flash photos. It's like, people, what have they just said?
I know. You know, people, I'm one of them, bless our hearts, because, you know.
Yeah.
The sign means everything to everyone else, except me.
Except
you know,
yeah.
It's just that kind of thing. But it's always, you know, when we get into the subject of ownership of certain things, it's very interesting. You know, especially if you know that there are multiple images of something, if you know that there's only one of something, you know, in this age of digital technology where you can just scoop up whatever and just use it, whether for research or anything else. But, you know, I think even – and it's really hard because we are all people that when you go to certain sites, they do ask that you give them credit. For if you're going to use these pieces, and of course it depends on how most people use them as to whether they give them credit or not. If you're going to put this in a book, it's most people, if they're going to that level, they'll give credit if they can to the source of the picture or the illustration or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's, you know, just not possible. I know I have things on my computer that have been there for, you know, maybe 20 years, and I'm like, wow, where did I get this from? Mm-hmm. You know, I know it may be something that's like a handwritten letter or something that's a little bit different, but I have no idea where I got this from, and I just know it's there. You know?
I know that a lot of the images, of course, let's say like Getty images, that are copyrighted. These are photos that have been taken, or perhaps they are images, clip art and whatever, and you have to pay to use them. And they're very serious about that, too, and I'll tell you, because I got spanked pretty hard, and it was on purpose. I can't say it was an accident. I used to have a regular newsletter that I sent out monthly to clients, and occasionally I would put some jokes or cartoons or something, and I had copied a cartoon that related to whatever the topic was in that month's newsletter from the internet. And before long, I got a physical letter in the mail from someone. No, I'll take it back. It was an email first, I guess, saying that you had used copyright material. I thought, this is someone phishing or spam, and didn't pay any attention to it. Long story short, I did get finally physical letters, and they weren't threats, but they were basically saying, you owe us. Even though, and I wrote back and I said, I've taken it off my website, I've removed it, and it said, it doesn't matter, you've already used it, and this, you owe us like $427. So,
it's like, I love the 27. 7. Yeah. You know? It's like, how'd you figure this out? You know?
So I finally paid just because I didn't want them to pursue it, because I thought, actually, you are in the right and I was in the wrong and I shouldn't have done that. Lesson learned. So I'm just passing that out to the universe also for people to recognize that just because it's on there on the internet and you find it, that you can't necessarily grab it, scoop it, use it.
That's definitely true. And I think now, like, you know, you can do a search for anything and do reverse searches. And I think when you look at things now and you search them, there's the general note that, you know, these images might be copyrighted. So therefore, consider that.
I think that's on everything now.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly. No, exactly.
If you do a Google search for images, that's on everything.
Right. So whereas before, it's just like, oh, you know, you're free. And some images may not have a copyright. Mm-hmm. But then it's kind of like it throws the responsibility from Google or whoever back to you. So you must be aware of this. You can't say you didn't know.
That's true. Going back to your website again, I remember some time ago that I was wanting to find out if I had an original litho or not. And I was doing some search and I found some interesting information on yours in which you take like a little loop and put that down on there. And you can tell whether it was actually lithographed or I guess, what is that, pressed into the ink, was pressed through stone printing in there. So whether it was a dot matrix or whether, I've forgotten exactly, you can probably explain better than what I'm saying. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. So, you know, sometimes someone will say, hey, what do I have? You know, is it a real litho? And I say, well, it has to be out of the frame, because generally they'll do it when it's in a frame. Mm-hmm. But so take it out of the frame and you can feel the paper. That's really the first thing. If it's smooth, then it's probably a four color press and done later into reproduction. But if it's kind of, I don't want to say bumpy, but if it's like, you know, cloth,
and rag material,
it feels like paper, right? Rag material. Then that's the first thing.
Like
then
a dollar
the next
bill.
Thing is like a dollar bill. All right. Get out a loop, get a magnifying glass even. You know, nothing terribly strong, and just look at it through that and see if you see individual dots, you know, for the color that's being laid down, and just see how it looks. And that'll give you another indicator. You know, also just turn the paper over or turn the image over. You know, if the back is rough and it looks like rag paper, then it's probably a litho. But if it's, you know, once again, if it's smooth, then probably not.
What constitutes a litho? What does that mean exactly in printing?
Oh, so lithograph. So done by stone lithography, it's a process of laying down – how to describe this simply?
It's kind of like screen printing, like a screen print
it's
T-shirt,
like,
different layers?
No. No, because it's totally different than that. With lithography, you're basically – you've got a big stone – and you're etching into the stone an image. And sometimes that image was reverse. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was not, because you can do it in two different ways. Mm. But then it's a combination of using oil and water as the basis of each of those repelling from each other. And that's what gives you stone lithography. So there has to be a stone. There has to be an image engraved into the – that's actually not engraved, but put onto the stone. And then you have to use a combination of its oil and water as your basis of the two repelling each other. And then you go through pressing the stone and getting the – transferring the image onto the original or the final paper or a transfer paper that then gets used for the final paper, the print.
So it's the weight of the stone and how it's pressed into the paper, so it becomes part of the paper rather than being printed on top of it like a four-color press.
No, it's not the weight of the stone.
No? Okay.
I'll tell you this very interesting thing. While at the same time, I'm making baguettes. So that's what I'm doing right now. I'm flipping them over.
You're living in Washington, D.C. now, right?
I live in Washington, D.C. I'm a mile and a half north of the White House. Mm-hmm. Everything is fine here. We're all good.
Good.
And it's been great. I've been here for, gosh, so long in Washington. I mean, I've been 20 years in this house, and I think I came up here in 87, maybe 85.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So So I've been here for quite a while.
I was going to say, yeah, that you have. It does feel kind of funny to be in one place for so long. I moved into this house in 98, and this is 1998, and this is the longest I've ever lived anywhere either. That we had moved around the country and different places then as well. And once that we got here, that it just it was the second time actually living in Houston. Whenever that you and I first got together, and we were working at the Magic Island way back when, and doing restaurants and things, that it was. I was living north of town, and then I moved later to Dallas. And then when I came back, you had already left. And one of my favorite memories of working with you was actually, I guess, not working, but just having some fun when we used to go to, it was a bar that's since been long time closed. It was a dive, and we would meet like on Tuesday evenings or something, and you and me and Bill Palmer, and I'd forgotten Scott Hollingsworth and some others maybe, and we were doing some late night magic and occasionally go behind the bar and try out some new tricks. It was really kind of a magic club, but without any rules or constitution or bylaws. It was just a group of us. Remember about half a dozen of us that just sessioned.
I don't remember the name of the club, but yes, I really do miss my time in Houston. And, you know, there's some things I miss, some things I don't miss, but I love my time in Houston, especially from a business standpoint, because – and I tell people, that's really where I grew my business. It's where I really got a lot of chops, because – there were so many opportunities for performance, and whether it was at Cooters, at the talent show night on Sundays, or performing in restaurants or clubs or comedy clubs in the area, or just being surrounded by really awesome magicians like Peter Studebaker and John Carney, people who are inspirational to me, like Scott Hollingsworth, where I had Scott's book about restaurant magic before I ever got to Texas, and then like that was my handbook, and then I really got to meet him and know him and become a restaurant magician, and just so many things, you know, Frank Price, there was you, there was, you know, just so many great people that were in Houston, Texas. It was just really amazing, and I was just really fortunate.
It was. It was a good time, a magical time, to kind of mystical, the way that things kind of came together, and then the way that people have grown from there. And that was one of the things, too, going back to working restaurants. Of course, you had as well written a book on restaurant magic, too, as I recall, didn't you?
I did, you know, because I was doing so much of it. There was one time I was working 10 different restaurants on 7 different days.
Amazing.
And some of them were like – I was considered this to be the oddest one. I was working at All Britain's cafeteria 4 times a week. So like Monday lunch, Monday dinner, and I think Wednesday lunch and maybe Wednesday dinner, you know, it was like 2 different times during the day, but during lunch. 2 different times during the week, but during lunch. I was working a happy hour on Sunday and Saturday. There was nighttime work. I was working at Brennan's of Houston. And just running around, just literally running around.
You were working a lot of different places. And I remember a few times filling in for you at the Kingwood Country Club at the grill, because you were doing their luncheons. And sometimes you had a private event or something that was over that or whatever. And so, but you were still working restaurants Sunday night as well as that Sunday brunch.
Right. And, you know, there was just so much going on. And it was great. You know, it really was great. And I remember when I first started, this was right after I'd worked for the Six Flags Corporation in Houston, that when the fall season came around, I just had more time because I was only working on weekends in the show. I literally got in my car and went restaurant to restaurant to restaurant in my car, repeating the same thing of, you know, I'm Charles Green, restaurant magician. Here's what I can do for you, you know, and until I was hired by one place, and that was Houlihan's. I think Houlihan's old place on Post Oak Road was the first place, and then they had several others, and then there was Brennan's, and then, then they just snowballed. And because of being so visible, that led to a lot of private parties and so on and so forth.
And that was – I've mentioned this so many times and over the years and to so many people, and using you as a benchmark and someone to aspire to be like, because –
there's trouble.
Well, because that you had a goal. One of the things that – as long as you know where you want to be, I think that that's great. But if you go and do something and then 10 years later, you're still doing the same thing, and you wonder, why didn't I get out of this? And it's because you didn't have a plan nor a goal of what you wanted to do, then you know, it's blame you. But you should have an idea. If you want to still be there 10 years from now, that's fine too, and that's a goal. But the point is that you had a specific goal, as I recall, and as I've told people, that you wanted to go and work trade shows and work more corporate events and do higher end types of things. And as a result, you worked at the specific restaurants that would give you access to business executives and then start to do their shows. And a little at a time, kind of after you got into the restaurants, to wean yourself off of that to be doing the corporate show.
Okay, now I'm going to answer that, but I've got to put the baguettes in the oven.
Okay.
And this is like they're going at 500 degrees.
Okay.
And
is this from yeast that you've actually been making? I mean, bread dough and whatnot?
No, or? I haven't been. No, no. Okay, wait a second. I'm going to need some time because this is the hardest part of the operation right here.
Okay.
All right, and we're good. Bingo. Okay, great. And then I've got to put in my ice for this. This is what I've become a master of, is making baguettes.
What does the ice do?
There we go. The ice creates steam, and so you need steam for the first 15 minutes, and then you open it, you get rid of the steam, and this is in a home oven, it's rather hard to get good baguettes.
As opposed to like a brick oven kind of a thing?
Exactly. Well, no, as opposed to a steam-injected oven that's available for professional bakers. So for people who really make baguettes, like, you know, operational things, they have ovens that inject steam and they have vents that can open and take the steam out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot better. But here what I do and what people tell me to do is throw in a cast iron pan at the bottom of the oven, and then you add ice cubes, not water, but ice cubes in there, and that creates steam, and then the ovens are baked on a baking stone, and you want to bake them directly on a baking stone as opposed to baking them on a cookie sheet or a baking pan that's on top of the stone, because when you put the baguettes in, there's something called oven spring that happens when they're actually on the stone and they hit that stone that's like 500 degrees. So
do most ovens go that high? Normally I don't go more than about 425 for most things I bake or warm up or whatever. So
yeah.
Do they go that high? Or is yours an industrial strength oven?
Mine's not, I mean, I've got a Viking. I've had this for 20 years. I've got a Viking. It's a good oven.
Yeah.
So it does go up to 550. And that's all I know. But and I would say, you know, one of the things that I am, and this goes back to the trade show thing, is that I can be terribly focused, and it can be a detriment for some things. But, you know, whether it's in poster collecting or, the story about Ionia, like once I get into something, I really focus and keep following until I get to the point of, like, perfection or the termination of something. So with these baguettes, this is now probably loaves 175, and I've made like 50 batches, and I've gone through lots of recipes. I've looked at recipes in French and in English, and I've talked to bakers, professional, high-level bakers that have won James Beard's awards, and as I've traveled and seen different good baguettes in different bakeries, I've talked to them. I'm consulting with someone saying, hey, I've got this. What am I doing wrong? Hey, look at this. What, you know, how can my baguettes be better? So I've gotten lots of great help from people to make these really, really good. And from what I understand, I'm in the top 1% of homemade baguettes. So,
wow.
There we go.
So what do you do with baguettes? I mean, do you make sandwiches with them, or you just have them along with your meals? Or
sometimes I have them with my meals, but because I make three in a batch, I give them out. You know, I give out like maybe two per batch.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I'm making a lot of bread, so I may make six baguettes in a week.
Make a lot of friends among your neighbors there.
Well, I do make a lot of friends. I've got these baguettes. I've got like two that are going to people who I said, hey, I'm going to make you a baguette. And they're like, good, because I've got scampi tonight. I need some bread. We're looking forward to this.
That sounds great.
But that relates to this thing of focus that I've had where with the restaurant work, I just got in my car, and at that point I had a 68 Dodge Polara that had no AC in the fall, you know, of maybe like 1980 in Houston. So it was hot.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just go like one restaurant to another, and I was focused. And you said, you know, I went to restaurants that were, that may have had better corporate clients or the access to those. And it really wasn't that case. I wasn't that, didn't think things out that far. It was just, I wanted to be in a place, I'm not sure what my rules were back then, but I know I had to be paid by the restaurant, that they would pay me an hourly wage. Mm-hmm. And it had to fit in my schedule. Now, some places, you know, wound up being better than others for different kinds of clients. So there was one restaurant, it was a bar that I worked that was on the Beltway just before the airport, like between Greens Point and the airport. Mm-hmm. I was there for a happy hour.
Yeah.
Yes, Beltway 8. And I was there for a long time and met a lot of people at the who worked in the airlines. And one time, and it was, you know, working a regular crew and being there every week, some guy said to me, you know, and just in conversation, well, you know, do you want to travel anywhere? I said, oh, I love to travel. And he goes, well, here's what I do. I'm like the head of DHL, and I can just put you on a plane and, you know, and you can go. I said, well, where do you go? I said, where's the furthest point that you go? And he goes, well, we go to Australia. He goes, I said, great. That's what I want to do. And so he said, great. Just here's all you have to do is like show up and we go to Australia for 3 weeks. And you can go. And on the way and on the way back, you'll stop in Hawaii. So they'll have a layover. We've got an apartment. And it's like, great. So I signed up and got to spend time in Hawaii. Had a wonderful time. Met some magicians there, Alan Okawa. Went down to Australia. Had a wonderful time there for 3 weeks. Came back. Went back to Hawaii. Had some more fun. Then came back home.
And you weren't doing magic, or you were?
Did I do any magic whatsoever on that trip? I don't think so. No. No yeah. Magic whatsoever.
Wow.
Just having a great vacation.
That's quite a tip, tip they gave you then.
Yes, it was. I was very, very grateful. But, you know, many of the restaurants, I mean, just because of Houston the way that it is, at least it was at that point, like kind of a small town where, you know, one thing led to another. So being very visible, a lot of social events, a lot of things at country clubs. A lot of people at country clubs, you know, were people who had companies. So that led to a lot of office parties, you know, during the holidays at any time. And then when I was doing – wanted to get into trade shows, I had seen – Dick Ryan. I had seen Dick Ryan at the Houston
OTC
Oil Show.
Offshore,
yes.
Technology Conference, sure.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it was – Oh, I can't think of his name. He's married to Wanda.
You were talking about Roger Klaus.
Roger Klaus, yes. Roger Klaus came into town and said, hey, do you want to go? And Roger was a great guy. I miss Roger.
Yeah,
and we talked about business stuff quite a bit at different conferences. And well, he came into town one day and said, hey, do you want to go see some people at the OTC show? Sure. So we went to see Dick Ryan. And I still remember him working for Sikorsky Helicopters. And it's like, I can do this. I can do exactly what he's doing. And that was kind of like the light that made me say, hey, here's my new focus. And so, you know, with some things being very flexible, you know, you get a new business card instead of saying, you know, party entertainment or party magician, you say corporate magician. And you change everything to a focus being on corporate entertainment. And you change from the tuxedo into the business suit, and there you go. And so that was a start. And then, when, you know, hopefully if you're doing a good job, you get one, then you get three, then you get five, and then you're off and running to this big career as a trade show magician.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it all happened.
So you kind of were, again, putting yourself in the right place at the right time and taking advantage of those opportunities. And as I recall, too, that you had famously said, as you just did a moment ago, you were receiving a compensation, an hourly wage, basically, from the restaurants and did not accept tips, was what I recall that was what you had famously said back then. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. I mean, that was a really big deal because there were many I'm not sure. Well, I knew of many magicians in the restaurant business who, you know, they always worked for a tip. They always kind of hung out. They always did tricks with, you know, bills or borrowing a bill with the intent of, like, I'm going to keep this. And I just couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And so I always said I need an hourly fee. I'm paid by check by the restaurant. And one thing that helped me with was then that helped me with accounting and saving money and getting definable income. So for Social Security
yes.
and everything else, you Now, because some magicians or some people in many fields, you know, they might make a lot of money, but if you don't declare the money, you don't get some of the benefits later. So,
that's a very good point. Yeah. So you need to pay into Social Security so you start to get that back at my age. Yeah. That's
exactly. You know,
a lot of people don't think that far in advance. And so that's why they're saying, hey, just pay me cash. I'm fine with that. And they may not declare it or whatever. So and as a result, they're not paying in. And so they're not going to get that back at a later time, which means they have to work a lot longer and a lot harder.
Exactly. And one of the things I learned, I don't think it was sent to me, but I kind of remember being somewhere in a private party. I remember being in a room. There were a lot of books in someone's house. And someone mentioned about SEP IRAs, and I had not had one at that point.
Could that have been Mercer Helms?
I don't know who it was. I think it was a woman. I think it was just at some private party. It wasn't a magician party. Oh, I was like the entertainment, and this is something that they said. And they talked about SEP IRAs, and it's like, wow, if you don't declare your income, you can't get the benefit of a SEP IRA, mm-hmm. you know, for maximizing that. And it all ties in together, because one of the things I did learn about magicians very, very early on is a lot of the great magicians I saw on the cover of Genie magazine and all those guys who were at FISM and the IBM convention, at the end of their life, they didn't have a lot of money. They didn't die well. I mean, they weren't really what I would consider to be successful, you know, so mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. you're a great magician, mm-hmm. right, financially, but you can't feed your family. You can't feed yourself. You don't have a house. You know, you've got to find everyone to take care of you. I just didn't want to be that. And, you know, I fortunately am not that. And, you know, you never know what will happen and different things do. But I did put in the thought of, I've got to have some end game. Magic is not the end of all that I do, and I've got to build something else other than doing magic.
And so how old were you approximately when you came to that revelation?
Wow, I must have been, I don't know, maybe 30?
30?
I know.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, not terribly young, but not terribly old either.
But young enough in which that you realized that, hey, I need to start thinking about the future at that point, as opposed to waiting until you're in your late 40s, early 50s, and thinking, hey, now I need to start worrying about it, but it's almost too late then.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, there's someone, I don't want to name the person, but I will tell you this, that when my trajectory from a financial standpoint is that working for trade shows, there was a lot of money. I mean, in relative terms, there was a lot of money being paid for what I do. And I took that money and I put it into real estate when I got into Washington, D.C. at a certain point. So currently, I've got three houses in Washington, D.C. That investment made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And it was a thing of the investment versus just having the money alone. Mm-hmm. And that idea of investing in real estate came from another magician that I know who's way more successful than I am. But it's kind of like that thought of, well, do you want a lot of money or do you want a great investment? And it's like, I want the great investment.
You want to have your money working for you rather than you working for the money.
That's it. Oh, and another thing was, and this may have come from Roger, I don't know. There's so many great magicians I had conversations with that didn't really involve magic. And one of them was, you want to be able to make money while you sleep. You know, you don't always
that.
Have to
That may
to
have been Roger.
Out.
That sounds like something he would have said. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you don't want to have to go out to do a show to make money. You don't want to have to go out of your bed to make money. You've got to find some way of making your money work for you and making money work while you just kind of sit in a chair. You know,
that's true, and having those alternate streams of revenue work for you, so this way that, again, you're not having to work so hard, but you still have something that's going to be coming in, and in perpetuity, basically.
Exactly, so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great advice. And so whenever you were doing trade shows, I thought it interesting, as with me, that you kind of do a little bit of everything, and before long you find one that seems to work best for you. In my case, because of my background and energy, it seemed appropriate. And so that's why I worked the OTC a lot of times, offshore technology and other kinds of those energy things. And you got into pharmaceuticals, which to me, I can't pronounce half, even a modicum of any of the language that you have to memorize for all of the instruments and the new meds that are coming out all the time and everything. So, I mean, it's interesting that you specialized in that area.
Well, I don't think I really specialize in that area. I mean, one is that area of pharmaceuticals in particular was unique because it had pharmaceutical companies did so many more shows than in other industries. Mm-hmm. So I had clients who were in the chicken farming industry, clients who were in the mechanical device of engines, airplane industry, I'm trying to think of other stuff. You know, I worked for Frito-Lay. They had snack food shows. But pharmaceuticals, if you have a pharmaceutical company, they've got so many streams mm-hmm. of doctors, associates, hospitals. And so for a pharmaceutical company, so my longest company may have been Sanofi Pasteur, and I worked for them 17 years and probably did 8 shows a year with them. Mm-hmm. Another company was Alcon Laboratories, who I worked for, I think, maybe 12 years. And I worked for them probably maybe 12, 15 shows a year.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it would be amazing because I would be working like, you know, a full, whatever, 10 shows a year. And then they would say, hey, we're going to take our product and we have these regional shows that are coming up and we're going to do like 6 of these regional shows and we want you at all of these regional shows. So boom, one company, then another 6 shows. And then they were like, well, our product is now going international. So we want you to do the rollout in Italy and we want you to do these European shows. Then when I did the European shows, there were companies that saw me there and said, hey, we've got a product that is, and it was interesting because they would say, we've got a product that's on a 10-year rollout. And we want you to be the magician, be our spokesperson for those 10 years. And so, okay, here's a schedule. And when the 10 years are up, you're done. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you're going to go, you know, to Paris, to Rome, to Barcelona, and we're going to do all these medical shows. So because I was in that industry just happened to have a lot of trade shows per company.
I just recall there was an article that was about you in the Wall Street Journal many years ago, and it was talking
yes.
about you being the pharmaceutical trade show business.
Yes. And, yeah, that's a funny article because I remember at that point I was still living in Houston. I'm checking my baguettes here. Okay, 50 minutes in. I was living in Houston, and the Wall Street Journal called, and they said, you know, this is so-and-so from the Wall Street Journal, and I hung up. I said, all right, I have a subscription, and I hung up.
Right.
And they called back. And I said, no, this is a reporter from the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
And we had a lovely conversation. So that was great. And that, you know, it's funny how these things happen where that article in the Wall Street Journal led to like a several page spread in Discover magazine. And that led to some other stuff. And that led to the Robb Report, you know, how things snowball and how things get picked up. So,
right.
You never know.
I want to go back to the restaurants again for just a minute.
Yeah.
Again, one of the other things that as far as not taking tips, as I recall, was that if someone worked, as I recall, we discussed this years ago, that if someone gave you a tip, even if it's a $100 tip or whatever, and then later that you say, this is how many thousands of dollars it's going to cost you because they want to hire you and say, wait a minute, you just spent 20 minutes at our table for $100 or $20 or whatever that it was.
Right.
And so now you're asking for this. That's a lot more. And so it's better for them not to know, rather to not receive the, for you not to receive the tip because it will be misconstrued as to what the value of your service is.
Well, that's true. You know, and I never had a situation where I'm trying to think because it's been so long where I was hired directly from a restaurant for a trade show. But it definitely I went from restaurants to doing a lot of social events, a lot of parties, a lot of galas. But it was that perception of money. And there's always that thing of being a magician that you're kind of always looking for money on the sly in
sure.
a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not the most glamorous profession because you have a lot of people say, oh, that's great. I've made your dollar bill disappear. I can't find it. Oh, and they go, oh, you keep it. It's like, I didn't want to be that. I wanted to come in, not have anything on my mind, except I want to entertain you with the best magic I can. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure you have a good time and I'm gone. Just tell your server that you like the magician. And that's really it.
And was the salary or the hourly wage that you received the same from each of the restaurants, or did it vary as to the type of food they offered, service they offered, or their location, or their clientele?
Oh, that,
or?
Really, this does go so far back. I would presume, knowing me, that the salaries were all about the same, mm-hmm. you know, and it was, you know, I was generally in for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
I do remember that one situation was with Brennan's of Houston, and I received that position being the magician, the house magician for Brennan's of Houston, because John Carney, I think, had it at the time before I was there, and mm-hmm. John was leaving town, and he kind of offered my name up and was instrumental in getting me to take over that position. And I think that that Brennan's offered me this, the situation of, you know, we can pay you X and you can come in and have dinner once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being young, I was like, I can eat at home. I'd much rather have cash. And so that's what I did. Now, it's kind of funny because I look back and I think, wow, I was surrounded by the best food in America.
Chefs. Yeah, right there.
Right. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, I really love food from New Orleans, and the Brennan's family is key to that. So I know I missed out on a lot of great meals. But I also know that by just being there, I learned a lot of things about that culture and about food service and about how to be a great host.
Well, going
so
into
I really
restaurants.
I appreciate my time.
And trying to find a restaurant, it seems as harder today than it was back then. And I say that because, again, you said you're working 10 restaurants in a week. And
right.
Around Houston today, I really don't know of any magicians who are working at any restaurant. And I don't think that that's necessarily from a lack of trying. It's just that in trying to find a location and to convince them that they need to have a magician to either help their business or
right.
have something unique. I mean, what did you say or do back then that would be a good advice that can still be used today, or was it a different time?
Well, it was probably a different time because this was the 80s and Houston was growing. And
yeah,
so there
boom.
Were a lot of people coming into Houston, coming into the town, and it was just go, 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 go. But at the same time, what I said, I'm sure, I mean, if I were to open up Scott Hollingsworth's book on trade show magic, I'm sure it's pretty close to the same thing that he wrote down.
Mm-hmm. On restaurant magic, you mean?
On restaurant magic. It's like, here's what I can do for you, and here's why you should have a magician come in, and then let me come in for a couple of hours on, you know, next Friday night. I'll do it for free, and you'll see how people like it. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
I did not start this from scratch. I definitely wrote on Scott's
suggestions on
coattails
from his book.
And suggestions
yeah.
directly from the book, because I had that when I was a kid in Hackensack.
That was one of the things also that he did for several of us back then, because as people were wanting magic, they realized that magic was a premier type of entertainment due to the Magic Island. They come there and say, well, this is fantastic. So this is what real magic should look like. And
sure.
so they wanted to have their own things. And so a lot of times that Scott would recommend you or me or Charlie McFarland or Bill Palmer, whomever else around town, saying, hey, here's somebody who can perform for you. And
sure.
so, you know, he was able to help us find those kinds of opportunities then, too, that we could then take off and with a new client. So that always worked
right.
out then well. So, yeah, things I know have changed dramatically over the years in restaurants and trying to find the right place to work and everything. I want to kind of come back again, I guess, full circle, too, when we begin talking about posters then to begin with. And again, that your website is called what?
MagicPosterGallery.com.
Great. And I want to talk then about the book that you are working on Ionia. And you were saying you've been
yes.
focused on that. But if you've been working on that for 20 years, it sounds like you might have lost a little bit of focus from time to time.
Well, I get focused on so many different things.
Yeah, you're going different directions.
and you know, I've got to say that when I grew up in Hackensack, New Jersey, just starting off in magic, one of the first books I had was Milbourne Christopher's Illustrated History of Magic. And I just read through that. And there were, the section that really held a lot of it, of grab for me attention, was the posters that were in that book. You know, Chung Ling Su, Thurston, Keller. Then fast forward, and I'm in Washington, D.C. I go visit George Daly. I see all these amazing posters on the wall. And I'm just hooked. From the get-go at that point, start collecting posters. As I'm in the collecting and magical historical world, I meet Eddie Dawes. And
who is in London, England, by the way.
Who's in London, England, actually in Hull, England, having had the pleasure of going up there and having gin and tonics with him and Amy. He's just the master of this, of magic history. And he wrote about,
right.
Yes, he wrote about Ionia. And in there, in his collection, he's got a letter from Charles de Vere, who is Ionia's father. And a portion of that letter, there's a postscript. And the postscript says, Ionia, who was my daughter, this is, I'm shortening this, but Ionia, who was my daughter, was in Moscow during the revolution, was like stuck in a hotel for 3 months, and all of her materials were pillaged. And then he goes on to say, if anyone knows anything more about Ionia, I'd love to know.
And what year have been written?
I think it's 1924, I believe,
okay,
that the letter was written. No postscript in the world has turned my life upside down like that one. Because from that and because of his request for more information, I have literally gone to Vienna, to Paris, to Hong Kong. I've met people who have helped me in this research that I've never met, who live all over the world. I've talked to people who are from Ionia's family, people who are related downstream from her. I've seen some amazing things. And there's just so much out there. There's stuff in FBI files. There's stuff in U.S. government files outside of the FBI. There's stuff in Russian files because she was in Moscow during the revolution. It really is an amazing story. And the people who are around her sphere, so her sister-in-law, her brother-in-law, her husband, or two husbands, her son, they're all amazing people who have great stories themselves. I mean, one was a prince, one was a lion tamer, one was a government, basically spy who went into Europe after World War II to look for secrets, rocket secrets from the Germans, the Nazis.
Hmm.
One was a prince. One was Joe Gotzel, who was in Hollywood during the days of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and actually was the president of Goldwyn Pictures and kicked Samuel Goldwyn out of his own company. It's amazing. But
Back for just a minute also to explain who Ionia it was. Wasn't she married to Alexander Herman?
No. No. Okay. So that was Adelaide Herman.
Adelaide Herman. Okay.
Adelaide was married. So
Ionia was who?
Ionia is the daughter of Charles de Vere. So Charles de Vere was a magician. He owned a magic shop in England at one point, also in Brussels and in Paris. He had his own performances and own theaters. His wife, Julia Ferret, was also a magician. She's known as Okita. So O-K-I-T-A, Okita.
Right.
They each have posters. So there are magic posters of them. They had 8 children. All of them were named with C. And for many years, it was a mystery as to Ionia's real name. Hmm. And I was able to find this out. It's Clementine's, Clementine de Vere.
Hmm.
And Clementine was their youngest daughter, their third daughter. And she is groomed to be a magician.
And she took the name Ionia, I guess. Isn't that a goddess? Or
it is a goddess. It is a goddess. It's a very special place in the Greek Isles. There's lots of history about the place Ionia. But she's takes this on, and her father creates this act for her. And some things are documented in magical periodicals of the time. Like it said that Charles de Vere is working on this act for his youngest daughter. And there are descriptions of the act because she did play in Paris, Lyon, England quite a bit. And it was generally thought that she ended her career in 1918 when the Russian Revolution happened. But that is not the case. She only performed for 3 years. And we know of most of her performances. But what happened was in 1907, she has a son with her first husband who is the lion tamer. Then in 1909, 1910, she does her first documented performances. The first one that we know of is in Lyon, France. And she's working with bears as well as doing some magic. Then we have other documentation of her act for the next 3 years. She's supposed to come to America to work at the Folies Bergère Theater in New York City. Not the one in New York, not the one in Paris, but the one in New York. That was the first dinner theater in America. But that closed down abruptly, and so she had to cancel that tour. She then goes on to stay in Europe. She's working in Vienna in the last year that we can document, which is like up to 1911, like December 1911, is the last performance time that we know of. And then she kind of vanishes. Well, by that point, the Lion Tamer has moved on to other things. She still has her son. Somewhere in that time period of 1911, 1912, she meets Prince Vladimir Aristavi Chicherin. And that's a lot to look up when you're doing research. And they get together, and eventually Clementine divorces the Lion Tamer, but that's not until like 1917, 1916. The prince eventually marries Clementine. And but they stay together, and the prince takes Clementine and her son from Vienna back through France up to Germany and into Moscow. And she's in Moscow when the revolution happens, and it's there that she loses all of her property. And I just happen to have a listing of all of her property, and I know that where she stayed when she was in Moscow, and this is some of the new information that's come up. So that's a scoop. But it's an amazing story.
Well, I can see now why it has taken so long with you making all of these trips and trying to research and trying to track down every little thread of information. And you'd mentioned to me also that if you go to your website, that you can learn 95% of what people need to know about Ionia, but you're collecting that last 5% for the book, I guess.
Well, no. What I'm collecting is more than the 5%.
Okay.
So if you go to the MagicPosterGallery.com. You look up Ionia, you'll see her posters. There are, I think, 11 of the 22 that were known or of, supposedly. But what's there are two articles about her life, and it's, you know, what most people know, and it's the accurate story because a lot of what has been told about her life is not true or was misconstrued or
like
things were – like what? Okay, I'll give you an example. There was a Oh, so some people thought that she performed up until 1918, and that's what the postscript information is dealing with. That all her materials were pillaged, and she lost them all, and they thought that she was in Moscow performing magic. Mm-hmm. No, she had given up magic long before that time, and she actually owned property in Russia. She owned two different estates in Russia, and I've got access to those files and documents of the selling and purchase of those plots of land. So that's one thing. She only performed for 3 years. Another thing, what else can I tell you? Oh, there are some things which are, you know, really minor but critical. There's some translations of French texts about her act that lead you to believe one thing, but actually there were misinterpretations, mistranslations, and with correct translations, it means something else. But no, she had an amazing life. And then once she gave up magic, she goes on to become a princess. Eventually she and the prince divorce, but she stays as a princess. She retains the title.
It's kind of like Priscilla Presley that kept her name after she divorced Elvis.
Exactly. and the strange thing is the prince went on to marry five times, and like every person that he married, whenever he divorced them or they divorced him, they all decided to keep the title of princess, you know, because like who wants to give up being a princess?
Well, yeah.
You know.
Right.
So
right.
She was Princess Clementine Aristavi Chitrin for the rest of her life. And then, oh, man, the baguettes are out, and they look amazing.
I can almost smell them from here.
You almost can. I'm going to pop them in for about 5 minutes, just turn them around, give the inside ones a little bit more. I'm going to take that one out. Okay, great. Yeah. So close the oven door. So she goes on to become a princess, and then I've talked to people who met her and who met her son. And they were, and I had to really convince them that the person they knew, the princess, had been a magical performer and had parents who were magicians, because they were like, oh, no, she's so regal, she's so aloof, she's so this. She could not have been, you know, tramping around with animals and horses and circus roustabouts. Yes, yes. And what makes this all possible, and probably the reason why the prince was attracted to Clementine, is that Clementine's brother-in-law was Frank Gotzel. It's Joseph Frank Gotzel. But everyone has at least three names. So that's what I found out in this research, at least three names. He was the head of Goldwyn Pictures, and he was a multimillionaire. Mm-hmm. And he had lots of money. This was back when $1 million really meant something.
Sure.
And he, from the French government, got commissions that were somewhere between like $1.5 million to $6 million, and then was able to parlay that into more millions. So Clementine, as Ionia, had access to lots and lots and lots of money. So essentially, she never had to work, you know.
Interesting. So when will the book possibly be out?
I've never written a book. I can't believe how difficult this is.
it is.
So my thing is, I believe the book is going to be an extraction of some things that are known, but there are going to be a lot of visuals. So I have probably at least 24 pictures of Ionia that have never been seen.
Mm-hmm.
I've got information, and then I want to do like maybe a chapter about each person in her sphere, such as the lion tamer, because he goes on to have a great life after Ionia, about the prince and what happened to him, about Gotzel, about Elise de Vere, her sister.
Mm-hmm.
I want to use a short bit about her parents, who were great magicians in their own right. But there's going to be a lot of documentation to say, here's the timeline of, you know, where she was born, when she was in Paris, here's where she lived. And I visited a lot of these places, have pictures, you know, here's the manifest that shows when she went from X to here.
Right.
You know, here's when she was in the paper for this.
Well, that'd be interesting once that all gets completed, because I know, for an example, Chip Romero has a similar kind of project in mind where he's trying to write a book on Doug Henning, and obviously he has most of the material, and he has a lot of things that people have never seen that he wants to bring to light in a book, and it just takes a lot of time. And I know the same thing, Walter Blaney. Walter's been writing a book for I don't know how many decades, and every time that I went to lunch with him, he always had these index cards in his shirt pocket, and he would pull out and write something, so this is going in the book, but has never happened.
The key thing is, you know, I don't want to be that guy. I mean, with all due respect to these people, you know, I want to get this done. And, you know, so there we go. That's the important thing, is to get this done. We're not getting any younger. I am trying to organize it in such a way that if something were to happen to me, because you never know how much time you're given, someone else could take this and they could write the book.
Right.
But it's all here. It's all here in Washington, D.C. at the moment.
That's great. Well, listen, as we wrap up over here, then, Charles, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast, and so I always like to close my podcast by asking what it is my guests have as their philosophy of life. What is your magic word or phrase? I don't mean like abracadabra. I mean like, what do you live by? What's important to you when you wake up in the morning that drives you, gives you energy?
Oh, you got to have some fun every day.
Ooh, that's good.
You got to have fun, and you have to be nice. Like, I don't try to hurt anyone. And I know that, you know, I can't make everyone happy. I do know that. I've had some friends that I've lost. I've had some friends who I thought were really near and dear who turned against me for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I've learned you can't make everyone happy. You've got to have fun. And, you know, you do your best, and then you got to move on, and don't wallow in regret and do things you need to do, because life is short. Life is very short, and I'm just glad to be here this long.
Well, I'm glad that we've been friends as long as we have, and it's great to reconnect with you over here. Then Charles is fantastic. So, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time today, and I hope to see you soon in person.
I hope it's sooner than later.
That'd
I appreciate
be great.
That. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Charles Green. This is Scotty out. Wow, what a delight it is to catch up with old friends. It's been so long since Charles and I have talked, and I'm glad that we reconnected and had an opportunity to share this great conversation. And it was, as you can hear, quite a casual one as well, so that he was talking on his phone while he was busy baking over there. And I hope that some of the background noise was not distracting, but kind of added to the organic feel of the whole conversation. And what a guy. What a guy that Charles is. I'm just so glad that he's my friend. And we've, again, reconnected. And so that was fun. And that's what a lot of the holidays is about, you know, trying to catch up with friends and being with family as best you can, and sharing times and sharing breaking bread, I guess, with each other. And that was a perfect analogy there with at the end over there with Charles having finished his baguettes. And if you want to take a look at what the baguettes look like, just go over to themagicwordpodcast.com and you can see the fresh loaves that he just pulled out of the oven, took a picture of that and sent to me, which I had posted along with some of the other pictures and some of the videos that you can see of some of his promo shots and promo videos that will help you tell you a little bit more about Charles. What a great guy. And thank you guys again very much for listening here this week. It's just been wonderful. Thanks for coming along here this year. And we still have a lot more to go in the future. And we've got somebody coming up then next week who is a regular guest of ours annually that we always get together. And so for Christmas Eve, we've got, again, this special guest who will be joining us next week. I know that you're going to love that. Thanks for listening. And I hope that if you have not signed up for our pod letter, please do. So this way that you can keep up with who is coming on from week to week and who will be up next week and some suggestions from the archives. Plus, you can be the first to learn about the contests whenever that we have these that are being offered. And we want to encourage you. We've got one more week to go. And we're going to be drawing the names next week, and we will be announcing them on the Christmas Eve program. So it's time to wrap this up and bring it on home. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember, life is short. Don't wallow in regret. Have fun every day. And don't hurt anyone, and do your best. Lots of great words to live by. This is Scotty out.